Okay, great. So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in for another Risk Institute online session. Today, we're especially fortunate to have with us Dr. Peter Sandman, a risk communication expert and specialist from the USA, to speak to us about his iconic formula, risk equals hazard plus outrage, and the three paradigms of risk communication. So that'll be the first half of the talk. And then he'll proceed to discuss to us some of his recent research on a critique of COVID-19 crisis communication. So the presentation will be around 1 hour and 1 hour, and then 20, 30 minutes for Q&A. Please, can you make sure that you have your mics muted and leave any questions in the chat or virtually raise your hand after the session, and I'll select them, the questions on behalf of Dr. Sandman. So just a quick introduction before we get started. Dr. Peter Sandman is the creator of the risk, hazard plus outrage formula for risk communication, one of the preeminent risk communication speakers and consultants in the United States, and has worked extensively in Europe, Australia, and elsewhere. He's received his PhD in communication from Stanford in 1971. He went on to become a professor at Rutgers University from 1977 to 1995, where he founded the Environmental Communication Research Program at Rutgers and was its director till 1992. He's left university to become a full-time risk communication consultant and started retiring in 2016. And by 2019, he was kind of 95% retired. And then he came back in January 2020. He saw the COVID-19 pandemic emerging, having worked on risk communication aspects of bird flu, swine flu, Ebola and Zika, and other infectious diseases crises dating all the way back from the start of HIV. So he's retired to help with the COVID-19 pandemic risk communication, and has come out of retirement today as well to give us his talk. So we're really lucky to have him. He tries to help from the sidelines, posting pandemic-related articles on his website, which you can check out on www.petersandman.com, doing media interviews, giving risk communication advice, solicited or unsolicited, paid or unpaid, to public health experts and officials around the world. And much of his efforts these days is via his pandemic effort is via his wife and colleague, who you can find on Twitter at EIDGeek. So without further ado, Peter, if you'd like to start your presentation.
Okay, thank you. As Francis suggested, the presentation is going to be divided into two pretty much unconnected parts. For the first half hour or so, I'm going to be talking about my sort of signature distinction between hazard and outrage and the three paradigms of risk communication that emerge from that. For the second half hour, I will be cherry picking some observations about pandemic risk communication. I should say that particularly the first half is old stuff. This is content that I evolved mostly in the 1980s and 1990s. It earned me a living as a consultant and sent my children and my grandchildren to college. But it's very old. I like to think it's still valid, but it's not like you're getting, you know, my cutting edge thinking. I'm not sure I have any cutting edge thinking. I should also warn you that the second half, when I start talking about COVID-19, is very US focused. I'm certainly aware of the United Kingdom and some of the interesting developments vis-a-vis the pandemic. I will be watching July 19 with some interest, and the run up to July 19 and what happens in England after July 19. It's not like I know nothing about what's going on in the UK, but it's not my intention to express opinions about that in the presentation. I'm going to confine myself mostly to US examples and US defects, and hopefully in the discussion in the last half hour or so, we can talk about what's the same or what's different in the United Kingdom over the last 18 months. The other thing that I think I need to say is both halves of this presentation come from somebody who's way more a consultant than a scholar. I like shooting from the hip. I put in my years in academia and I published some and I actually did quantitative research. And I didn't think it was nearly as much fun, to test hypotheses as to generate hypotheses. So I left the university and have spent the last several decades telling paying clients what I think, based on consulting experience, based on some reading of other people's research. Since I'm talking to an audience of scholars, I need to be very clear that I am not one of you. You're hearing today from a consultant. So if some of what I say, you have data that suggests I'm wrong, or for that matter, if you have data that suggests I'm right, I would love to, you to email me with citations, because I am educable, but I'm not really educated on the last decade's worth of risk communication research. So that's all in the nature of forewarning. So let me start with the traditional definition of risk. Francis, can I have the next slide, please? This is what happens when you bring in a retired person. I'm still pretending it's the 1950s and I'm asking for the next slide instead of controlling my own slides. But let me start with the traditional definition of risk, particularly among engineers, and most of you are aware of that traditional definition. It's a multiplication of two things: magnitude times probability. How bad is it if it happens? How likely is it to happen? And you multiply your best measure of those two, and you get what engineers traditionally mean by risk. Back in the 1980s, I tampered with this definition. Next slide, please. And I said, okay, let's redefine risk. And the way I redefined risk is to start by taking the traditional definition of risk and giving it a new label. Next slide, please. I said, all right, let's call what technical people define as risk, let's call that hazard. And then I said, let's take what the public considers risk, next slide, please, and call that outrage. And I need to pause to say that, I picked the word outrage in the 1980s and I'm stuck with it now. I have no intention of changing it, but it's a word that works pretty well with environmental controversies to describe how the public feels about a risk. It works less well with, say, public health emergencies, where fear is a bigger component and anger is a smaller component. Outrage doesn't seem to be quite the right word. But by outrage, I certainly mean fear and its wimpy cousin concern. I mean anger. I mean any kind of, misery, any kind of emotional component of the risk. And all of that is what I mean by outrage. And so putting these two terms together, I coined the formula that is my signature formula. Oh, Francis, you're anticipating properly. I said, properly considered, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, technical people hate two things about this formula, typically. They hate the fact that I consider outrage at all, because they want to say risk is hazard, period. And they hate the plus sign. I spent years giving presentations to engineers who would murmur, that's what happens when you let a humanities major write a formula. So I came up with the formula down at the bottom: risk is a function of hazard and outrage, because techies like that much better than my very untechnical use of the plus sign. Now, there are a few things before I go on that I want to point out about this formula. First of all, it is grounded in the very low correlation between what I'm calling hazard and what I'm calling outrage. That is, the very low correlation between how dangerous the experts think a risk is and how upset some public is getting about that risk. That correlation hovers in the vicinity of 0.2. according to several studies decades ago. Accounting, as all of you probably know, you square the correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance, accounted for a glorious 4% of the variance. So there's practically no relationship between hazard and outrage. There is, however, quite a high relationship, quite a high correlation between perceived hazard and outrage. That correlation, according to at least one study, is around 0.7, accounting for about half the variance. So it's a good, robust correlation. And of course, anytime you have a high correlation, the question you ask, if you're, you know, any kind of scientist at all, is what's the direction of the causality? And in this case, then looking at the correlation between outrage and perceived hazard, the question we're asking is, are people upset because they think the risk is dangerous? Or do people think the risk is dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If they're upset because they think the risk is dangerous, the solution is to convince them that it's not dangerous, assuming that you think it's a small hazard. If, on the other hand, they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them. So if you're going to manage this relationship, you have to know its causal structure. You don't want to be in the embarrassing situation of trying to manipulate an effect in order to influence the cause. That's you know, not good engineering, and it's not good science either. My IMAP just closed my connection. That's not good.
We can still hear you and see you.
You can still hear me, but I can't see my slides anymore. I have no idea why my IMAP closed my connection. That's never happened before. Let's see if I can get it back. There we go. Okay, if it does it again, I'll get it back again.
No problem.
Okay, so basically we've got this very low correlation between hazard and outrage, very high correlation between outrage and hazard perception. And it turns out if you look at that high correlation, the outrage is mostly cause, the hazard perception is mostly effect. It's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions. But for the most part, people are not upset because they think the risk is dangerous. It's much more the case that people think the risk is dangerous because they're upset. The same is true in the opposite direction. It's not mostly the case that people are calm because they think the risk is small. It's much more the case that people think the risk is small because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. And actual hazard isn't the engine of either one. Hazard is important, obviously, for its own sake. I'm not suggesting it doesn't matter whether you're killing people, but it has very little effect on hazard perception and very little effect on outrage. It's important off in a corner, but hazard perception and outrage are yoked at the hip, with hazard perception mostly the effect and outrage mostly the cause. So, based on that.
Would you like me to change the slide?
No, I'm about to ask you to change the slide. You're doing just fine. Based on that, what I wanna do is a graph hazard against outrage. Now we can have the next slide, Francis. And I want to look at the relationship between hazard and outrage and derive what I have defined as the three paradigms of risk communication. And let's start in the lower right-hand corner, next slide, please, with risks that are high hazard, low outrage. And that's the venue of the paradigm that I have called precaution advocacy. People are insufficiently upset about a genuinely serious risk. So the paradigm is watch out, do something. take precautions or demand precautions if you're an activist trying to get people to demand precautions, or tolerate precautions if you're a government agency trying to get people to live with the precautions you're imposing on them. So all of that is in the venue of precaution advocacy, where in your best judgment, the hazard is serious. People are not taking it seriously enough. Next slide, please. And the very essence of precaution advocacy is reflected in this arrow. The most fundamental principle of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. And that's not for the fun of it. It's because you understand the causal structure I just talked about. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase people's willingness to take precautions or demand precautions. I don't believe my IMAP did it again. Take precautions or demand precautions or tolerate precautions. So you're I'm coming back again. Okay. Someday I'll have to figure out why it's doing that. It's never done it before, but we can. It only takes me 30 seconds to fix it. So you're trying to increase the outrage, and you know, without going through the entire toolkit of precaution advocacy, some of the strategies are very straightforward. You have to keep your message short. You have to make it interesting. You have to repeat it a lot. All of that, all of those are because low outrage people are not very interested. So attention span is short. You want to appeal to needs. You want to appeal to emotions. I have a list of strategies of precaution advocacy on my website, and they are all grounded in the idea that when people are insufficiently upset and therefore not taking precautions, in order to sell precaution taking, you have to get them more upset. And if you're not willing to get them more upset, then you're doing precaution advocacy with one hand tied behind your back. Next slide, please. In the opposite corner, we have risks that are high in outrage and low in hazard. This is the second of my three paradigms, which I call outrage management. And if the essence of precaution advocacy is watch out, the essence of outrage management is calm down. The message isn't calm down because calm down is not a calming message, especially if your tone suggests that what you're saying really is calm down, you foolish idiot. That doesn't calm people down, but the goal is indeed to calm them down. Next slide, please. And just as the essence of precaution advocacy is to increase the outrage, the essence of outrage management is to decrease the outrage. You're trying to get people less upset so they will be less inclined to take precautions or demand precautions or even tolerate precautions that you consider unwise and unnecessary. Now, obviously, different people may have different assessments of the hazard. So some people may be judging that the hazard is too high, that the outrage is too high for a trivial hazard, and others looking at the same situation may be judging that the outrage is too low for a significant hazard. So you may be doing precaution advocacy while a company is doing outrage management, or you may be doing outrage management while an activist is doing precaution advocacy. But both of you are aiming in your own judgment for the center line. If you imagine a line from the origin up to the upper right-hand corner where outrage and hazard are equal, that's what you're both aiming for given your disparate judgments of how high the hazard actually is. So strategies of outrage management, again, I don't have time to go into them in any detail, are things like stake out the middle, acknowledge prior misbehavior, acknowledge current problems, share control, be accountable, give away credit. These are all covered in mind-numbing detail on my website as the counterintuitive strategies for calming people down, the ways you get people to be less upset about a risk that you think they are overreacting to. And I add that data aren't very useful in accomplishing either of those tools, either of those tasks. Data don't help much with precaution advocacy because people aren't paying attention. Data don't help much with outrage management because people are too angry. When you tell them they're not going to die, they get angrier because they would rather think they're going to die than think you're not the Antichrist after all. So data are not useful in precaution management or in outrage management or in precaution advocacy. Okay, enough of that. Next slide, please. In the upper right-hand corner, we have the third of my three paradigms, crisis communication. And next slide, please. There's no arrow to draw for crisis communication. You don't want to make people less upset because they are rightly upset. You don't want to make them more upset because they are upset enough. You're already on that midline where outrage and hazard are commensurate. But there's still risk communication to be done. Your job now is to guide people, to guide their choice of precautions, to help them bear the situation, help them bear their own outrage, and help them bear the very serious hazard. So there's still a toolkit, and I'll get to that toolkit in part two and when I talk about COVID-19 crisis communication, but there's no arrow. So this is yet a different paradigm. Next slide, please. Down in the lower left-hand corner, we have low hazard, low outrage. I'm not going to put a circle down there because I have never found that to be a profit opportunity. I earned my living before I retired in the other three corners. But what are you going to do if our hazard is low when the outrage is also low? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. That's not an important message. So I think there's no risk communication to be done in the low hazard, low outrage corner. If you're there permanently, if you're there temporarily, that's another story. You may anticipate that the hazard is coming or that the outrage is coming or that they are both coming and therefore do pre-precaution advocacy or pre-outrage management or pre-crisis communication. But if you're permanently in the lower left-hand corner, there is no risk communication to be done. Next slide, please. In the middle of the graph, we have what I call the sweet spot. And this is not one of my risk communication paradigms, but it could have been. This is essentially the paradigm of public participation. People are interested, but not freaking out. The hazard is serious, but not urgent. Everybody can relax and talk. So if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. The paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. The paradigm in the sweet spot is something like let us reason together. The sweet spot is very dialogic. It's very calm. It's what public participation people aim for, and sometimes imagine they have when they don't, and they're surprised either by an apathetic audience that doesn't show up, or an outraged audience that hijacks the meeting. But sometimes you're genuinely in the middle of the map, and public participation can happen just fine. So that's the essence of what I want to talk about. Next slide, please. These are the three paradigms. I didn't list public participation as a fourth paradigm. Watch out, calm down, we'll get through this together. And the essence of my message for the first half of my presentation is there are three toolkits for these three very different kinds of risk communication. And if you, in my judgment, if you're going to do risk communication, you have to start by assessing the hazard, assessing the outrage, deciding, you know, how much hazard is there, how much hazard faces this audience, how outraged is this audience, and then extrapolate how hazardous is the situation going to be, how much outrage are people going to experience, and based on your analysis, you know where you are on the map and where you're going on the map, and therefore you know which toolkit you need. So, I mean, in the language of medicine, you have to diagnose before you prescribe. And you have to analyze where you are on the risk communication map, the map of hazard and outrage, before you decide which of three entirely different risk communication toolkits you need. Next slide, please. I'm not going to go through this list, but this is some of what I mean when I talk about outrage. If a risk is voluntary, controlled by yourself, the sources are trustworthy, the process is responsive, and so on down the list, you're going to feel safe even if the hazard is high. If the risk is involuntary, others are in control, you can't trust the people who are talking to you, they're not listening to you, it's an unfamiliar risk, it's you can remember things going wrong, and so on down that list, you're going to be upset and alarmed and angry, even if the hazard is quite low. So these are, you know, some of the variables that add up to what I'm calling outrage. And I have to do this again. I have to add, let me do it first. There we go, thank you. I apologize for the fact that my computer is misbehaving. I have to add that, you know, we have lists of outrage components and we have pretty decent measures for them. What we don't have is an algorithm for putting them together. We don't know what the regression equation would look like in order to calculate how much outrage a situation presents. I have some intuitions on that as a consultant, and I've spent, you know, decades advising clients on, you know, this situation is going to be pretty mild and this one is going to blow up in your face. But, you know, while I can measure the components, I can't measure the outrage as a resolution of those components. I think that's all I want to say in the first half. Francis, how am I on time? I should have been running about half an hour. Am I ahead or behind?
You've got 35 minutes left.
I've got how much left?
35 minutes.
35 minutes left. Oh, good. Then that's perfect. So where does COVID-19 fit in my map? Next slide, please. And it fits in all three places. There certainly is or was a need for COVID-19 precaution advocacy. In March and, you know, January, February, March into April of 2020, there were lots of people who were insufficiently upset about the pandemic or about what was on its way to becoming the pandemic. And the task, and it's a task that we didn't do very well, was to warn people, was to alert people to the possibility and then later the probability that this was going to be the big one, or at least the biggest one since 1918. So the task was precaution advocacy. There are still ways in which the task is precaution advocacy. I'm not so convinced that the holdouts, the people who are now still denying that COVID-19 is a serious event, I'm not so sure that they're apathetic. They might be in denial, which is a different story entirely. I mean, denial isn't when you're insufficiently upset. It's when you're so upset you can't tolerate it, and the toolkit for denial is totally different from the toolkit for apathy. So I'm not sure that there are people still apathetic about the pandemic, but you know, if there are, then precaution advocacy is what's needed. And there are certainly vaccinated people or people in low circulation parts of the world who are becoming apathetic, who are experiencing the lull as the end. When you're in a lull and things are going to get bad again, maybe not as bad, but worse than they are now, you return to a need for precaution advocacy. There has also been and continues to be a need for pandemic outrage management, particularly vis-a-vis vaccines. Vaccine hesitancy is an outrage management problem. The vast majority of people not getting vaccinated, as far as I can tell, are more influenced by their doubts about the vaccine than by their insufficient worry about the virus. There's some of each, but clearly outrage management is relevant vis-a-vis vaccine hesitancy. There's going to be a need for outrage management post-pandemic. People who are in fact at low risk, even in a lull, who are having a difficult time adjusting to how low their risk is, who are encountering something like post-traumatic stress disorder. And once again, outrage management may be the tool for them. But obviously, I think the most relevant of the three paradigms is crisis communication. By and large, the biggie, certainly, once people became aware of the pandemic, once lockdowns were happening and continuing into the present and into the future, pandemic crisis communication has been the main task. Pandemic precaution advocacy and pandemic outrage management still play a role, but I think a secondary role. So what I want to do in the time that I have left is cherry pick from my pre-existing list of 25 crisis communication strategies, some of the strategies that I think are being or have been badly handled vis-a-vis the pandemic. And again, I'm relying mostly on my US experience. I think many of the conclusions are the same for the UK, but I'm not certain all of them are, and I'm not going to opine on what's going on in the UK. Next slide, please. So I have divided my list of 25 crisis communication recommendations into four groups. And the first group is called How Bad Is It? How Sure Are You? And it has the seven recommendations that are on your screen. I think all seven of these are being pretty badly handled during the pandemic, but I want to focus particularly on number one and number four as examples of poor crisis communication. Number one, don't over-reassure. Over-reassurance backfires whether the hazard is high or the hazard is low. I mean, if you over-reassure people in high hazard situations, which of course, in my judgment, COVID-19 is certainly a high hazard situation. Two things go wrong, either or both of two things go wrong. Either they believe you and they don't take precautions, or they don't believe you and they take the wrong precautions and don't trust your guidance thereafter. So either way you lose. If you tell people not to worry about a risk that deserves to be worried about, you're doing harm if they believe you and you're doing harm if they don't. So over-reassurance is I think certainly one of the most common, maybe the most common crisis communication mistake that is made. And it's a weird thing. I mean, I've spent my career or much of my career with public health agencies that routinely advise people about risks that they're not taking seriously enough. I mean, precaution advocacy is the dominant stock in trade of public health. They're endlessly telling people to take precautions they're not taking. And then along comes a crisis and people are taking precautions. They're doing what public health people have been urging them to do forever. Finally, you've got the teachable moment. Finally, they're listening to you. Finally, they're taking the risk seriously. And public health freaks out and tells people to calm down. I find it perplexing, but I'm used to it by now, that the tendency to over reassure in a crisis, even on the part of people who have been warning that this crisis is going to come someday, and finally the crisis comes, and they over reassure. I don't think I need to go beyond what I've already said, but I think the ways in which in the early months of the pandemic, officials were over reassuring, I think is too obvious to belabor. So let me skip to number four, acknowledging uncertainty. And I need to say very aggressively that uncertainty is hard to communicate. If you are trying to acknowledge uncertainty, it is still difficult. People don't want to hear it. Journalists don't want to report it. At every step in the communication process, uncertainty gets filed away. So if you want to communicate uncertainty, it's not enough to acknowledge it. You have to proclaim it. You have to insist on it. And there are, I think, reasons to do that. And let me list some of them. Uncertainty is more credible. It's confidence building. I learned early as a consultant that if I tell clients I'm not sure I'm right, they believe me more. They take more of my advice if I acknowledge uncertainty than if I don't. So it builds credibility. Acknowledging uncertainty is more sustainable. If you change your mind, the fact that you weren't sure in the first place makes it easier for you to be willing to acknowledge that you were wrong and change your policy. And it makes it easier for the public to accept the change. Overconfidence makes it harder to change and harder for the change to be accepted. I think acknowledging uncertainty is less divisive. Assuming that there is disagreement, and this shades into number six, acknowledging opinion diversity. If there are people, even other experts, who don't agree with you, dueling PhDs, one expert is confident that it's X and another expert is confident that it's Y, and either they're being snarky and nasty about each other or they're ignoring each other and pretending this is the, you know, my opinion is the only opinion. And we saw both of those patterns often in the pandemic. The far preferable pattern is to say, look, this is what I think, and I'll tell you the evidence about why I think this is the case. But I know experts, who think something different, and I know that, you know, they have evidence too. And, I can talk about why I think they're wrong and I'm right, but, you know, we don't know who's right. And there are opinions besides mine, and I am not certain I am right. That kind of, a respectful acknowledgement of opinion diversity and acknowledgement of uncertainty is, I think, demonstrably the kind of risk communication that works best in a crisis. It is, however, the kind that officials and experts are least likely to do in a crisis. And again, this is a little perplexing to me in principle, although I've gotten used to it. Experts are endlessly writing that further research is needed. They're endlessly writing in their articles for peers that they are not sure. And, my study has the following nine reasons why you shouldn't trust it. That's not usually exactly how they phrase that, but you know, here are the problems with my my study that might undermine its credibility. And you know, within the expert field, there's this strong need to acknowledge uncertainty and to acknowledge opinion diversity. And then suddenly there's a crisis, and you're talking to the public, and you're talking to a frightened public. When the need to acknowledge uncertainty and opinion diversity is highest, the tendency to claim certainty and pretend everybody is on the same page is strongest. So it's very common in a crisis to get number four and number six, as well as number one, wrong. And I think we got them wrong during COVID-19. We're still getting them wrong. Vis-a-vis whether we should go back to school or not, you know, whether kids should go back to school or not, vis-a-vis whether non-pharmaceutical interventions work well, vis-a-vis the list goes on and on and on. Virtually every demonstrably debatable issue about which pandemic policy had to be made, experts were reluctant to acknowledge uncertainty and reluctant to acknowledge opinion diversity. And much of the loss in credibility that has been documented, certainly documented in the US vis-a-vis CDC, where trust and credibility has slid badly. But I think credibility of science, credibility of experts, credibility of public health officials has taken a hit in this pandemic. And in my judgment, it has taken a hit largely because of number one, that is over reassurance, number four, reluctance to acknowledge uncertainty, and number six, reluctance to acknowledge that other experts have opinions different from your own. So let me go on, next slide, please, to the part two, coping with the emotional side of the crisis. I'll focus particularly, I'll focus at least a little on number 10, forget emotions other than fear. I do think fear is paramount in a pandemic and has been paramount in COVID-19. But for the most part, officials, you know, if they paid attention to emotion at all, the emotion they paid attention to is fear. They have responded wrong to fear. They have tended to say, don't be afraid. This gets me to number eight. There's been a strong tendency to over-diagnose panic and claim people are panicking when they're just taking precautions. But still, at least that they're aiming at the most important emotion in the pandemic, which is fear. But I think they're neglecting another emotion that is maybe as important or nearly as important, and that's misery. And the distinction between fear and misery matters, because while fear is provoking precautions, misery is provoking people not to take precautions. If you're miserable locked up in your home, you're miserable not seeing your grandchildren, not seeing your friends, not going to the pub, whatever it is that about the pandemic that's making you miserable. And there are the experts and the officials talking to your fear of the virus, but not talking much to your misery about the pandemic precautions. And if you're not addressing the misery of the last year and the misery of the current situations, you're not addressing the emotional side of the crisis. So I think although fear is obviously super important, I think misery is also important. I also want to emphasize number 12, to legitimize people's fears. It's never a good idea to tell people not to be afraid. I have to mention the head of the World Health Organization, Mr. Tedros, who endlessly evokes the mantra, facts, not fear. And I think he's wrong on both words. Facts turn out to be not terribly important in managing the pandemic. I mean, you need facts to set the policy, but convincing people to endorse the policy and obey the policy is not highly dependent on the facts you tell them. And fear is far more your ally than your enemy. Tedros, I think, is just dead wrong in thinking, he has said several times that the virus is a bigger enemy. Fear is a bigger enemy than the virus. He said that a bunch of times. Fear is a bigger enemy than the virus. If only that were true. If only all we had to do is calm people down and everything would be okay. And I'm pretty convinced that the virus is a bigger enemy than fear. In fact, I don't think fear is an enemy at all. I think fear is an ally. We need to legitimize people's fear and harness people's fear as a way of mobilizing their willingness to take precautions. And that's all I want to say about the second category. Next slide, please. Part three is involving the public. And on the whole, I think, you know, the officials and experts have done a pretty good job of involving the public. We've certainly done a good job of offering people things to do. We have told them things to do. And I think perhaps that raises an issue vis-a-vis number 17, that there's been a tendency in the pandemic, as I think there usually is in a crisis, to make everything either required or forbidden. And between required and forbidden is the venue of voluntary. And if I had been advising officials and experts in the pandemic, I would have had more voluntary precautions. Not people are doing voluntary precautions anyway, but experts are not often recommending them. What's optimal in a crisis is to provide an X, a Y, and a Z. X is the minimum we recommend. You know, at least do X. Even if you think we're overreacting, do X, but please at least do X. Y is our real recommendation. We would rather you did Y than X. Y is more hassle than X. It's more protective than X. It's what we think the situation at the moment calls for. If you're trying to do what we recommend, you'll do Y. Z is maybe a little overkill. It's more demanding than Y. It's more protective than Y. We don't think it's entirely necessary. But if you feel more vulnerable than most people, maybe you are more vulnerable than most people, if you're more concerned than most people, if you think we're not taking this seriously enough and you want to go beyond Y to Z, do so with our blessing. So if you offer people a menu of X's and Y's and Z's, then you're letting them choose their own actions. You're not just giving them things to do, you're giving them choices of things to do so that they can titrate their own risk budget. They can decide how much at risk they think they are. They can decide how much at risk they are willing to be. And they can decide which from your menu of precautions are the ones they want to take to get their risk down to the level they've decided they want to get it down to. And mobilizing people's ability to do that, I think, is optimal. I'm okay with number 16, but I think we haven't done a good job with number 17. Number 18, ask more of people. I was shocked that early vaccinees and people who had been infected were not mobilized as volunteers. The only challenge trials I'm aware of were done in the UK. So I give you guys credit for that, but you know, I was very surprised at the reluctance to do challenge trials, which is a way of asking more of people. When we started rolling out vaccines, I would have urged people who had been infected and recovered to go to the end of the line, and that would be a way of asking more of people. Very early in the pandemic, instead of telling people that they don't need masks, it would have been better to say, yeah, masks are useful, but we need them so badly in hospitals right now that we hope you will forego the benefit of masks until we have more, or at least the benefit of surgical masks and N95 masks, and save those for hospitals so that, you know, if God forbid you need to be hospitalized, your healthcare workers, the people taking care of you, will have proper PPE. There are a variety of ways we could have asked more of people and did not. Next slide, please. Part four is errors, misimpressions, and half-truths. And I'm guessing, Francis, that I'm very near the end of my hour. So I will just say, because it's too obvious to belabor, you look at number 19 and number 20, I think we've done a really crappy job of acknowledging errors, deficiencies, and misbehaviors, not to mention apologizing for them. Certainly in the US, and I think in the UK as well, officials have sometimes corrected their errors, deficiencies, and misbehaviors, but rarely acknowledged them. The claim is almost always new science tells us that we should do X instead of Y. And it's never we were wrong when we recommended Y and we're sorry. It's always, we were right at the time, but now we have better science and we're moving on. And even that was often delayed. So I think 19 and 20 have been pretty poorly done. Ditto for number 22, which I've kind of already mentioned, be explicit about changes in official opinion, prediction, or policy. If you're gonna go from masks are useless to masks are essential, you should say, last week we said masks are useless and we're changing our mind and here's why. You shouldn't just change the policy and pretend that it didn't used to be what it used to be. Lord knows both the UK and the US have gone through endless shifts in policy with very few candid acknowledgments that, our policy has changed. Here's why it changed. The prior policy was suboptimal. We're sorry. It's not hard to do that. There's no loss in stature when you do that. But it's horribly difficult, apparently, for not just for officials, but even for experts who are advising officials to do any of that. Next and last slide, please. Here's a list of my current gripes, or at least some of my current gripes about US COVID-19 risk communication. And I'm gonna kind of read these off, but not talk about them. And if we want to talk about them during the Q&A and discussion, we can. Selling health instead of telling the whole truth. I promise not to talk about them, and I'm terribly tempted to talk about them anyway. I'll talk about number one just a little bit because it's a generic problem in public health. Given a choice between saying the thing that will get people to do what you want them to do or telling them exactly what you know, warts and all, public health people pretty much always choose the former. And I've spent 40 years advising them to choose the latter and losing that fight. And I can give you advice. I can give you examples from any of those 40 years because I have at least 40 examples of that. And it's a generic problem. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, they have certainly saved lives by turning public health into propaganda rather than candid health information. I think they have undermined credibility along the way. And I think it's bad policy, but I've almost never succeeded in convincing a client to say something to the public that isn't going to push them in the direction, in the behavioral direction that the client wants to push them. So, public health sees risk communication as tell them, you know, cherry pick the available, they don't lie, or they try not to lie, cherry pick from the available truth, the truths that will get people to do what you want them to do, and ignore the rest of the truth. Well, that's all I want to say about number one, and I'm really not going to say anything about the others. Confusing values and political ideology with the science, pessimistic bias, false consensus and suppression of minority views, overconfidence, and reluctance to acknowledge uncertainty and ignorance, abandoning harm reduction and pretending we can crush the virus, and doing so without saying you changed your standard. Harrison Bergeron, Public Health, and if you don't know what that means, go read that that short story, the Vonnegut short story, but it's basically prioritizing equity over public health, claiming all COVID-19 vaccines are equal, which is nonsense, and finally insisting on standard operating procedure as if this weren't the worst public health emergency in the Western world in the last 100 years. And that's all I want to say. And let's open the floor. And Francis, you're going to moderate this discussion so that I don't have to try and figure out which of the many comments that have been flashing on my screen we're going to talk to.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for your talk. I know that I've taken quite a lot from it with regards to mental models. And I think you're right. People act quite emotionally to things rather than respond to the facts. So embedding that into writing for research when we're talking about risk is important. I've really taken some things that hopefully I'll be able to integrate in my own work. So one of the first questions, which is more of a joke, but Scott asks, Fox News explores the low hazard, low outrage corner, doesn't it? but that's just a joke. So the next question, if Alex, you'd like to unmute yourself, because you've asked quite a few.
Yeah, I've been kind of flooding the chat there with questions. I guess a lot of them are just kind of thoughts, but condensing it down, I guess the most important question I've got there is like, what is effective risk communication? Is effective risk communication a communication that gets the recipients to perceive risk in the same way as you? But it sounds like from what you've been saying at the end that you disagree with that. And I would disagree. I don't think that's sufficient for risk communication to be effective. But it seems like that's kind of it's the problem you run into, because effective risk communication requires a large degree of honesty and openness about errors and misgivings and things. And I can imagine a lot of places are very, very, very reluctant to actually engage with that.
I'm going to take a middle position. I have for decades taken a middle position between the two extremes, but let me define the two extremes first. I mean, you know, the first extreme is tell people everything you know, see your job as informing them, period. The opposite extreme is tell them whatever will get them to do what you want them to do. And between those two extremes is what I consider a position that's both sustainable and useful. And that is try to reproduce in your audience the level of outrage that you are experiencing and that you consider justified. So it isn't telling them everything you know, it's telling them everything that will get them to see the risk the way you see it. But that's not the same thing as telling them whatever will get them to do what you want them to do, even if you know it's crap. That's the middle ground that I have, you know, for years endorsed. I do think that risk communication is not just risk education. It's not just teaching them. It does have a behavioral payoff. But on the other hand, it's not propaganda, and it has to be sustainable, and it has to be compatible with long-term credibility. And that means not lying, but it also means not cherry picking which information to give people and which information to deny them. So in the middle between those two, it seems to me is trying to get to that midpoint on my map, where they're as upset about the risk as you are and as you consider it desirable to be?
May I come with a question or comment? Unfortunately, I can't get my camera on. So there's a technical issue.
I'm not sure whether
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
No. thanks very much for your talk, Peter. Peter Sandman. I'm experiencing at the moment or exploring older people's experience during the pandemic in UK, and I interviewed 33 participants, and many of them that they are so scared of the news and what the prime minister said that they don't watch the news anymore. So I was just thinking your recommendations of informing the public and whatever it's necessary to outrage them to take especially precautionary. I think this has failed because if they don't watch it, how can they get the news or how can they be informed? And I just want to hear.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just want to hear your opinion about it.
I mean, my sense is generically people who say they don't watch the news are somewhere between lying and redefining what it means to watch the news. They're not no longer on Facebook. They are not no longer talking to their friends and family and neighbors and coworkers, et cetera.
It would be interesting to ask the people who claim they are no longer paying any attention to the news if they see any significance to any of the following dates, and then give them say four dates, one of which is July 19. And I'll bet you they're going to say, oh yeah, I know all about July 19. So yeah, they're watching the news.
You might be right. So some comments said, so they stopped watching, and a few sentences later they said, oh, just once a day, the headlines. But it still was striking to find that so many were scared and had anxiety and depression that they started to either reduce it or I'm not sure how much they really said they don't watch it at all, but that's what I've got in the data.
Yeah, no, I mean, what's stunning about the UK to me is in the last week is there has been explicit disagreement about a very fundamental question. You know, given how thoroughly we have vaccinated our people and given how serious the Delta variant is, you know, as we look at those two new situations, we are newly highly vaccinated and we are newly facing a much more transmissible variant, you know, should we stay locked down? Should we open up fully? Should we work out some middle ground where we're reducing the lockdown but not eliminating it entirely? And opinions, well-informed opinions in the UK have aggressively, explicitly disagreed. Sometimes respectfully, sometimes not so respectfully, but the disagreement is in the face of the public. People know perfectly well that the prime minister is taking a risk, that there are well-informed advisors who think that risk is wise and other well-informed advisors in and out of government who think that risk is unwise. Given that my recommendation is acknowledge uncertainty, acknowledge opinion diversity, that's happening now in the UK. And your data is saying people are finding it scary. Yeah. And I agree, people are finding it scary. People would rather the experts agreed. People would rather there was no uncertainty and there was no expert disagreement. My position is that, you know, in a world in which there is in fact uncertainty and there is in fact expert disagreement, you need people to come to terms with that rather than protecting them from it and hiding it from them. They don't like it. They get angry at you for acknowledging uncertainty. They get angry at you for acknowledging expert disagreement. They get frightened. They get anxious.
And you have to help them bear all of that and not back off of it.
So you would highly recommend the way the UK is promoting it at the moment, because the frightening is pushing them forward to take precautionary actions.
I think people are in a position now to genuinely know that nobody knows whether the Freedom Day is a good idea or not. That's true. I mean, all the experts know they don't know. So for the public to know they don't know is progress. And if the public in England can't live with that, then I'm going to have to rethink whether, you know, I should be wise to advise that kind of candor. But I'm hoping that, you know, not that they're going to like it, that's too much to hope for, but that they're going to be able to bear it. And maybe you and I and others can help officials and experts in the UK and especially in England, help the public bear it. But I'd be very reluctant to back off of it, because it's essential candor. This is an experiment, as many experts have pointed out. The entire world is going to be watching England in the days after July 19 to see what happens. Much of what the rest of us do is going to depend on what happens in England. So it's a valuable experiment. It's a dangerous experiment. I want you to do it right. Doing it right isn't pretending you're sure. Now, maybe we can do a better job of helping people bear it, but I don't want to try to start pretending it's not so.
So for my perspective, it's frightening. It's frightening what they are doing right now, because they changed the health secretary last week or so, and this new health secretary is driving a new way, which had been, I think, the last Matt Hancock was a bit reluctant to go ahead that straightforward with the herd immunity, which we had 1 year ago already, and it was seen that so many people died of a sudden and really quick. The number were rising really, really quickly, and I think it's frightening to see how this government is dealing with compared. So I'm German, and comparing the German news, there is still discussions about this as well, which frightens me as well. But seeing it's more stable. So the decisions are more stable and saying, okay, we have such and such numbers. And if we go above in the R number, we are closing down schools, we are closing down shops. And this is a kind of balancing, opening up, closing down. It's annoying for the people, but it's kind of stability in the actions. Whereas here, I think it's more frightened because this experiment, as you said, it's dangerous. It can be dangerous for everyone.
I think though that people, at least people that I speak to, they know it's an experiment and they know that nobody knows the answer until you try it. But they buy into the hypothesis that actually, if you don't do it and you don't try it, then you're never going to do it and you're never going to try it. There is always going to be a reason not to open. So even though we don't know whether now is the right time, at some point you've got to do something and you don't know what's going to happen, but you've got to roll the dice in a sense. And people will know
implicit in what both of you are saying, it seems to me, is maybe there needs to be more clarity about the fact that we will change our mind if we have to change our mind. And I know the Prime Minister has been on both sides of that. I can find times when he has said, no, this is irreversible, and other times when he said, well, of course we'll reverse it if we have to.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just assume that the latter is what is the truth. But it would be lovely to have standards in play that say, all right, if this happens and this happens and this happens, or if two out of these five things happen, we're going to reinstate something like lockdown.
This would be brilliant.
Whether it's framed in terms of the R or in terms of the hospitalization, the relationship between infection and hospitalization is obviously going to be different in a highly vaccinated population than it was pre-vax. We have to think about what signifies failure in the context of not just of infections, because we know we're going to see a lot more infections, but the question is, how much harm will those infections do? And, maybe the Great Barrington Declaration is going to turn out, to have been wrong in a pre-vax world, but right in a post-vax world, where we can let the mostly young, mostly healthy, unvaccinated part of the population let it rip. I would like to see clearer standards than I have seen, and maybe they're there and I just haven't seen them, but it would be nice if you launch the experiment with clarity about what the conditions under which you will abandon the experiment. And I don't know if you've done that as well as you might have.
Well, Singapore recently—
I'm not aware of that. Sorry, Adolphus, yeah, go on, ask your question. You've had your hand raised for a while.
Yeah, thank you. All right, basically just two remarks. So first one, I was about to say that, so Singapore is another country that I think is going to like do an experiment on a endemic COVID-19 world. And the only difference between here and back in Singapore is that in Singapore, they're really going to monitor very closely. The task force is all on high alert to continue monitoring the R values, the clusters, identifying the clusters of the where the outbreaks are happening, and so that they can reintroduce the restrictions once anything goes out of hand. And if they could localize the outbreaks, then that's of course the ideal case. So of course, this is still is very early stages. We are also trying to look at the results and see what does this so-called experiment is going to tell us. And basically my question is, I have another question that's basically essentially, as the resident advisor of my hall, because I'm currently taking care of students in living in a university hall, I've noticed over the year we had a group of people who are well aware of the risk of COVID-19 and all the problem that comes along with it, but they still choose to believe that the world is still normal, and they continue to have parties in groups of hundreds. Literally, I shut down a party that had 100 people in the kitchen. And where do you classify this group of people? Those who are well aware of the risk, and they know very clearly this is a danger to us, but they still continue to behave as if we're going to get it at some point in time, but we're young, we won't die, all that.
Could I just jump in with a slight addition to that as well?
Oh yeah, please.
Just the notion of trying to promote voluntary actions. I can see, I think it's important to engage the public and make them understand the shared responsibility that they have to commit to things as well. But I think, I know from a lot of people I've spoke to, the notion that in the UK, at least, a lot of things were kind of left to your own discretion for a lot of the, for a lot of last year. And it was kind of, well, this isn't explicitly banned, but you should think carefully about whether or not you should do this. And I know a lot of people were frustrated because they felt unsure and anxious over whether or not something could be done, but they felt like there wasn't, they were basically looking for some kind of guidance from the government, and maybe promoting voluntary actions leads to anxiety and decision making there, and cases like Adolphus mentioned, where you have people who will just quite happily refuse to take up the voluntary actions.
I mean, I'm not recommending that governments fail to give advice. I'm only recommending that they give advice that includes a range. So that they are explicitly saying, look, if you want to just do what we say, here's what we want you to do. But if you want to do less, here's a menu of sort of the minimum. And if you want to do more, here are some suggestions that go beyond what we're recommending, but we're on board with them too. so that you're blessing voluntary action, but you're also giving explicit advice. So I think those are compatible with each other, and you can do both, and you should do both. With regard to the point Adolphus was making, I'm tempted to just say, look, adolescents are adolescents, the same people who ride motorcycles too fast and experiment with drugs dangerously are experimenting with COVID dangerously. And most of us remember when we were idiots too, and most of us survived and some of us didn't. If I had some notion that risk communication can turn adolescents into adults prematurely, I would share that knowledge.
Unfortunately, I don't think it exists, like, right? Yeah. Actually, this is very relevant as a resident advisor in my hall, because communication is actually one of the things that is key, in making sure that the students know what to do and guiding them through surviving, in their first year in the hall, in their first experience of being independent from their families and all that. But more often than not, we're just getting people who, get the message coming in one ear and getting out from the other ear, thinking that they know better than us. Yeah, so that's the unfortunate truth.
Yeah, and lots of universities have experimented with, varieties of voluntary versus coercive standards, I don't know in detail what they have learned about what works and what doesn't, but my sense is they've learned that nothing works. There are responsible students and they will behave responsibly. There are irresponsible students and they will behave irresponsibly. And you can help a little by advising, by giving more coherent, more respectful, more empathic advice, such that, the responsible students at least can hear you more, and you're not providing easy reasons to not know what to do or to blow you off because you're being contemptuous or you're being arrogant or whatever. But that's about, all you can do is not make things worse. You can't turn adolescents into grownups.
No, for sure we can't. And also, I think the policy making by the university is very, very questionable, because many of the policies that they came up with works in theory, but in practice it's hard to implement. Like, for example, when they say that, students are not allowed to socialize between clusters. Okay, but there's only so few of us resident advisors. How can we police everyone and be everywhere at the same time to make sure that nobody crosses socialize between different corridors or different blocks? And I think many times when they come up policies, they should also figure out the feasibility in its implementation rather than just thinking of things just in theory or in principle that it works, but on the ground, people on the ground would find difficulties in implementing those policies.
Yeah, and as I think we all know, rules that can't be enforced and aren't enforced undermine not just themselves, but all the other rules as well.
Yeah.
If you're not going to enforce the rule, or you can't enforce a rule, you ought not to promulgate the rule. At most, you could say, we hope people will do X rather than Y, but we know perfectly well that we can't enforce it. So, if you're trying to be responsible, do X and avoid Y. And if you do Y, we told you that was idiotic, but we're, don't expect us to enforce it because we can't.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think I caught COVID recently, and just the suggestions of when the track and trace people are calling you, almost threatening you, saying if you leave your house, we're going to fine you, but they never arrived. It wasn't very nice having someone just kind of tell you these rules and the punishments whilst they're not enforcing them. It just felt like a kind of empty threats almost. Not that I was going to stop self-isolating, but I can see how for other people that might be quite triggering and kind of incentivize them to break the rules somewhat, but reverse psychology almost. A question that I have as well is, have you, Peter, thought about what the thresholds might be for when the COVID crisis might become more of a outrage management case?
Um, Did my audio just go off?
No,
no, it didn't.
You're still
okay.
Here.
You can still hear me. Okay. I think I'm now on the computer instead of on my AirPods, but that's all right. I'm sorry. Would you ask the question again? I was thinking about whether I could be heard.
Of course. So my question was, have you thought about, from your perspective, when you think or what the thresholds might be for COVID becoming less of a crisis communication case and becoming more of an outrage management where people are more trying to are basically living in fear of something that actually isn't much of a hazard anymore?
Yeah, I mean, there are two answers. I mean, the usual pattern is when a crisis is over, the recriminations become more important than people's fear. You know, that they stop focusing on wanting to be saved and start focusing on wanting to apportion blame. And that's in fact sort of diagnostic that, you know, when recriminations are a bigger piece of the dialogue than fear, the crisis is over, or at least people think the crisis is over. And that, you know, if they're right that the crisis is over, the task becomes outrage management. If they're wrong that the crisis is over, the task becomes precaution advocacy. But either way, when they start being more interested in blame than they are in their own risk, they think the crisis is over. So that's one answer. The other answer, Francis, is that you need outrage management already and have needed it for some months now vis-a-vis vaccine. That the overreaction to clot risk, the overreaction to myocarditis risk, those are both outrage management problems. And they're outrage management problems that have not been well handled, in my judgment, but that's a whole different presentation on how you do outrage management and why vaccine outrage management has been poor. I think that matters a lot less than why pandemic crisis communication has been poor. In my judgment, true that the subset of people who are excessively alarmed about vaccines, we have not spoken to their concerns in ways that that do good outrage management.
Can't be seen. I can't move and be. my question, which bothers me, is what kind of role does play the trust from the government, the trust from the media, the trust from the so-called scientists, whoever is promoting the vaccine, for example. So as I experienced, my trust and a lot of trust in the UK has been lost due to the, handling how they are saying one thing yesterday, another thing tomorrow, and you probably don't know what's going on. Is this outrage management? Does it relate to trust? How would you think?
I mean, trust is important in all three of the risk communication paradigms, but I think you're right that trust is particularly important in outrage management, and mistrust is in fact a kind of outrage. What you want is people who are outraged at the virus, not outraged at the government. when the government is not trusted or the experts are not trusted, you have a high level of outrage, and you might think, oh, good, Sandman said a high level of outrage is desirable in a crisis, but not, you know, you want a high level of outrage at the pandemic, not at the people trying to manage it. So mistrust is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And my sense is a very, among the major sources of mistrust is overconfidently saying things that turn out wrong. I think there are certainly other sources of mistrust, but I think that's been the biggie that we could have done better and we need to do better.
And so another question related to trust, when we look at the numbers of people who don't want to be vaccinated, though there had been lots of rumor and what is implemented, you know, with this chip theory and so on. How do you suggest to address this?
Since you mentioned the chip nonsense, I should start by saying, you know, all the available research suggests that people's mistaken, false and obviously false and easily falsified opinions about vaccines are a result variable, not a cause variable. People don't get anti-vax because they think that Bill Gates put a chip in the vaccine. They think that Bill Gates put a chip in the vaccine because they have decided they're anti-vax. Rebutting those beliefs has essentially zero value. Because the beliefs are ammunition, they are not reason. So you have to go way more deep than that to why are people reluctant to get vaccinated? And you know, there's the generic answer about anti-vaccine values generically and vaccine hesitancy generically. And those are themselves different. Being anti-vax is different from being hesitant. But being either anti-vax vis-a-vis this particular vaccine or hesitant vis-a-vis this particular vaccine is not just and may not even be primarily the generic factors, but factors that are specific to this situation. In the US particularly, obviously, vaccine has been highly polarized. Politically polarized. And the single best predictor of whether you want to get vaccinated or not is whether you voted for Trump or for Biden. I don't know to what extent, you know, something like that is true in the UK, but in the US, you know, the public that doesn't want to get vaccinated, I mean, there are four or five identifiable publics that are reluctant to get vaccinated. The two biggest ones, neither of them is generic. You know, one is actually the three biggest ones, you know. One is, you know, Trump supporters who don't want to get vaccinated because they think it's a Democratic thing to do. The second is people of color who don't want to get vaccinated because they mistrust the public health establishment. And the third is young people who don't want to get vaccinated because they think they're immune to the virus anyway. And they think it's not something they need to worry about. Those are, I believe, in the US, the three biggest cohorts of reluctance or refusal to get vaccinated. And none of those are about chips or false opinions, and none of those are about generic vaccine hesitancy either. They are specific to the specific situation. And I'm guessing there is an equally specific situation in the UK that presumably has been diagnosed and certainly needs to be diagnosed before you can say anything coherent about how to address it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Alfreda. I think we have time for one more question. I know some people haven't asked anything yet. Do we have any more questions from the audience? Maybe from Nick or Vlad, Scott?
Well, I do, if nobody else does.
Go ahead, Scott.
I was just kind of chuckling when you were talking about how unlikely it is that risk communication is going to turn adolescents into adults, because I have an equal pessimism about its ability to turn grown-ups into adults.
I was thinking that, Scott, even as I spoke. I was hoping nobody would call me on it.
But my question is, why do you, it's actually about the companies that you consulted for. Why do you think it is that they always go the cell health route rather than the full disclosure route? Do you think it's because it works or because they're afraid to go the other way?
Well, you know, it's a different answer for public health than it is for companies. I mean, you know, my experience with my corporate clients was that quite often I could convince them. I had to convince them. It's not like they started out believing it, but I could convince them that it was more in their interest to be candid than to be dishonest. And I could make a case that, you know, two things were both true, that dishonesty was likely to be exposed. And that dishonesty was likely to be punished. That if they, you know, to sort of take the classic corporate client, they're putting dimethyl meatloaf in, you know, out the stack of their factory, and dimethyl meatloaf is a carcinogen. So there might be a cancer cluster in the neighborhood. There might not, you know, but they're certainly emitting, you know, X tons of dimethyl meatloaf, and they don't want to admit it. I was able to convince a lot of clients.
But why doesn't it work for a health professional or a public health professional?
Well, let me get there. I was able to convince a lot of clients that they would be better off telling the truth, because if they didn't tell the truth, A, they would get caught, and B, once caught, they would get crucified. Right. And the reason the same is not true of public health, and I have been much less successful in convincing good guys to be honest than I was in convincing bad guys to be honest, is because good guys aren't policed nearly as well. When I was trying to convince the polio eradication campaign, for example, that they should be honest about the fact that the oral polio vaccine occasionally gives you polio, which it does, not very often, but, you know, it can give you polio. It can cause small outbreaks of vaccine-induced polio. And I would say, be honest about that. And they would say, no, if we're honest about that, parents will be more reluctant to get their children vaccinated, and we're going to save lives by hiding that fact. And their best ammunition was, most of the time, people, if they lied, didn't catch them. And when people caught them, they didn't punish them much. You can't win journalistic prizes by exposing public health dishonesty the way you win journalism prizes by exposing corporate dishonesty. And when public health dishonesty is exposed, the public doesn't say, oh my God, this is horrible. The public says, oh, well, you know, they were trying, they're altruists. You know, it's, you know, environmentalists are allowed to lie, and so are public health officials allowed, if not to lie, that's an overstatement, at least allowed to exaggerate, to cherry pick, to mislead in ways that get corporations crucified. So it is my judgment that in the long haul, it is unwise for public health people to do it too. But I have much less evidence that public health dishonesty backfires than I have that corporate dishonesty backfires. And I was much less successful over 40 years in convincing public health clients to be honest than I was in convincing corporate clients to be honest.
Yeah, that's exactly my experience too. We worked for the Electric Power Research Institute, and they were always incredibly scrupulous. But when we worked for EPA, they would say anything. It was shocking. It was truly shocking.
There it is. You said it in two sentences. It took me three paragraphs.
Well, but I never understood why, but I think you're right. It's the policing. And also they sort of get out of jail free card because everybody knows their heart's in the right place, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
Okay, well, let's wrap up because it's reached 4:30. So let's thank our speaker again. Thank you very much, Dr. Peter Sandman, for your talk. It was incredibly inspiring. Loads of mental models there and kind of guidelines that I think will be incredibly useful. I know you said it was dated and not cutting edge, but I still think it's extremely relevant today. And, you know, you've really kind of listed out things that I still feel like haven't been executed even now. So clearly, it's still cutting edge, at least in my opinion, and I'm sure in many other people's as well. So thank you again, and stay in touch. I think if anyone wants to check out your work, they can find you on www.petersandman.com, correct?
Correct.
If you have any last words, then hopefully stay in touch and we'll follow your work closely.
Absolutely. One thing I want to say at the end that I also said at the beginning, I am not a scholar. I gave that up because consulting was, for me, more fun. If you have access to scholarship, your own or someone else's, that either confirms or disconfirms some of what I said, I would love if you would send me citations or copies of studies. I don't have the self-discipline to keep up with the literature, but I'm willing to keep up with the literature that's about me. So if you know of studies that reflect on the kinds of things that I've been saying, I would love to hear from you.
Okay, great. Well, I'll pass on your email to anyone that has any queries, questions, or anything they'd like to share with you or get your advice on. Yeah, it was great to have you. Thank you so much again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Peter.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll be uploading the talk onto YouTube if anyone would like to share it more widely. Okay. Thank you. Have a great day.